Welcome to this Worldview podcast for Engelsberg Ideas and the latest in our series of reflections on war. I'm Adam Bolton. In this episode, we're going to look at the battlefield as exposed following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The desire to fight wars more effectively has always resulted in innovation, from the use of horses and artillery to air power, walkie-talkies and radar. Since the total wars of the last century, warfighting has often become more remote, though no less deadly, through the use of planes, missiles, drones, and now artificial intelligence. Yet the war in Ukraine has looked much more familiar, with tanks, snipers, sieges, bombardment, and advances and retreats. So what is happening on the battlefield in Ukraine, and what does it tell us about warfare in this 21st century? Later in this episode, I'll be joined by Professor Hugh Strawn with a historical perspective on the fighting in Ukraine. First, though, I spoke to Dr. Rob Johnson, director of the Changing Character of War Centre at Oxford University, who's recently been appointed to lead the UK Defence Secretary's Office for Net Assessment and Challenge. I began by asking him exactly what kind of war we're witnessing in Ukraine.
I think the expectation has been that this was going to be a sort of very 21st century style war involving what the Russians call grebidnya vojna, or hybrid warfare. And although there have been aspects of all the fighting characterized by, say, long-range weapons, and we've all been struck by the superiority of the latest generation of anti-tank and anti-air weapons, handheld ones at least, the interesting thing is that this conflict has taken on a very traditional look. I mean, it has turned out to be a very conventional war, characterized by trench warfare and armored maneuvers and the importance of logistics and the crucial importance of junior level of command. So I think we've been a little surprised that it has not perhaps been more modern than we thought it should be. But of course, it's a reminder that all war doesn't change its nature. And I think that's been amplified by the current conflict.
And that means, of course, if it's not hybrid war by other means, it's all the more brutal and bloody.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've always known about conventional war, particularly when it's fought at scale like this, is that it's characterized by large amounts of destruction, often of infrastructure. And by that, of course, we mean cities. And we only need to look across the ruins of Mariupol to see that. But also very high casualties. And although people are very quick to make judgments about, doesn't this conflict prove the obsolescence of the tank because the large numbers of armoured vehicles have been destroyed, the fact is that in conventional war, large numbers of vehicles are destroyed. So I don't think we can draw, you know, quite so quick conclusions yet. I think we have to accept that this is the nature of conventional war.
And it also means, when we talk about brutality, that you're coming into hand-to-hand contact with civilians and with other fighters, and that can mean very often that the rules of war get broken.
Well, that's been the biggest shock of all, I think, because we expected that Russia would conduct itself like a regular professionalized army. After all, the Russians have been telling us for years that they've been professionalizing their army, conducting military reform. In fact, again, the striking aspect of this war is the indiscipline of Russian soldiers, right down to the tactical level, all sorts of problems with command and control. Officers are clearly not providing a moral compass or restraint. If anything, they're actually encouraging the brutality that we've seen in locations like Bucha. And I think what's made that worse, of course, is that as the Russian soldiers are being defeated and rolled back, the indiscipline simply gets worse. And as morale sinks, then there is a temptation of Russian soldiers not to obey even basic laws of armed conflict.
Of course, even going back to the Red Army, the Russian reputation was for no holds barred, really, in terms of its behaviour.
That's correct. And we should remember, you know, the historical examples here, that Russian military doctrine has a rather, the French would call it guerre à l'outrance, you know, all-out war sort of ethos. And what that means is that the securing of any objective, it means that they will use all means to get it. Whereas in the Western world, we're familiar with the idea that in order to capture an objective, you use the minimal amount of force, very selectively, with precision if possible, to prevent civilian losses or undue destruction. That hasn't been part of the Russian way of war.
And in this case, they apparently are actually using the civilian population, both abducting it into Russia and apparently in Mariupol bringing in Russians to take up residence.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because in, you know, Russian propaganda, they'll make a big play of the fact that they're providing humanitarian relief and they're trying not to target civilian areas. But what we're actually seeing is the opposite. And you're quite right to say that this is a result not of an ordinary state at war. This is a criminal mafia organization used to breaking the law, using all means at its disposal, including, you know, use of hydrocarbons as weapon systems of economic warfare against the Western world, taking human hostages, trying to brutalize populations and to terrorize them into submission. This is not what we've come to expect from the conduct of a major power. After all, a permanent five member of the Security Council, this is an absolutely abhorrent set of behaviours. But of course, it's characteristic of that type of government.
What about the Ukrainian side? How are they fighting this war? Because although in Europe there hasn't been so much concentration, certainly in American media, there have been reports of execution of prisoners and things by the Ukrainians as well.
Well, I think one of the tragedies of all war is that, you know, atrocities beget atrocities, and that where family members have been stood up and shot or tortured, branded with swastikas and all the other brutalities that we've seen, the survivors, the young men and women who've survived those experiences and found themselves in military forces in Ukraine, come across personnel that they now despise, they know have mistreated their own countrymen, then they take the law into their own hands. I mean, it is appalling, and it's a tragedy of how war actually is. Now, of course, some of the things that the Ukrainians have done, very cleverly, they've managed to, you know, dominate the information space to the West and given the impression that it's all going their way. Of course, it hasn't. We haven't seen the broadcast of Ukrainian losses, which must be absolutely enormous.
And as far as the fighting force, the discipline of the fighting force, and indeed the integration of the Ukrainian fighting force, have you been impressed by that?
Oh, I think we all have. But then these things can be explained. I think for all of us listening to this, you know, if our own homeland was invaded and that the invading forces conduct themselves in a very brutal fashion, many of us who would otherwise in ordinary life dismiss taking up arms or acting in a military fashion would find ourselves in that situation. Ukrainians do really believe that they're fighting for their very existence. They've seen enough of the atrocities to believe that they've got to fight. They can't surrender, because if they do, they will be either executed or tortured or deported. So that helps us to explain a little, I think, of what's going on here. There's also a sense this war has gone on for so long for the Ukrainians. You know, after all, we must remember the invasion began in 2014, that they were losing the initial conflict, but they've had to learn how to fight. And I think that what they're exhibiting now is the use of the right techniques to keep the Russians at bay and to roll the Russians back. They've not put themselves into obvious concentrated locations of armour. They've deliberately dispersed themselves. They're fighting from deep inside forest blocks or from entrenchments or small underground positions, making attacks in a very fluid fashion, withdrawing, not giving the Russians time to find them. When they operate artillery, they fire a few rounds and then they move away so they can't be targeted so easily. And of course, as we've all seen, making extensive use of drones to provide themselves with situation awareness and targeting. So they've fought a very good tactical sort of fight. The problem that they're about to face is that the infrastructural damage to their country, both financial and economically otherwise, is so large that they've got to now move from thinking about winning battles or holding their own and actually starting to think about a longer term conflict.
Now, you mentioned the term at the beginning about a hybrid conflict, which, as I understand it, is using, you know, means short of weapons, things like cyber and assassination and all the rest of it. Now, until now, we thought the Russians were rather good at that in terms of what's happened in America and, of course, the Skripal and Litvinenko assassinations here. Has that just gone wrong?
I think it's reached its sort of limit because of the way that Putin gambled about the start of this war. There's some evidence to show that he thought that this seizure of power, this coup de main against Kiev, would only take 3 days, and that this would follow a sort of pattern of either the suppression of democratic movements that we saw in Belarus briefly, or in Kazakhstan, the industrial unrest there. And the model, I think, for Putin was the seizure of power of Kabul in December of 1979. It followed exactly the same format, airborne and special forces arriving in the capital, followed by these road moves, these vast armoured columns coming up to consolidate the capture of the capital. But the model has not followed the December 1979 one of Afghanistan then. It's rather more followed, perhaps, you know, some of the British listeners will be familiar with, the Arnhem story of airborne forces being cut off and frankly destroyed before they could be rescued from the ground. The failure of that coup de main meant that there was no room now for the use of some other hybrid methods. They found themselves in a war, and despite all their denials, trying to call it a special military operation, they now had to carry on and fight through with that war if they thought they were going to win it. Putin still thinks he can win, which is interesting. I suspect that after the fighting has died down, we will see Russia try to return to those hybrid methods. But as we've already seen, public opinion in Europe and the United States has hardened against Russian information measures. And therefore, I think that disinformation by Russia will be far less effective than it was up until 2022.
How do you think President Putin would define a win at this stage?
I think he's going to be confronted with a stalemate that he can't do anything about, and that he will simply try to declare some sort of victory when we can't tell. We don't know if that's as early as the summer or whether it will actually be later in 2022 or in early 2023. We can't actually tell. But it'll be a hollow victory that he'll declare. The only other thing that he may have to confront is that while he wages an economic war against the Western world, that the sheer strength and scale of Western economies means that that will be less affected than he thinks. He may even face a regenerated Ukrainian army that is able to roll back Russian troops right back to the start lines and indeed beyond, perhaps right back to the traditional borders of Ukraine. So I think whichever way Putin tries to portray it over the next 12 months or 2 years, I'm afraid it's not going to go his way.
You said at the beginning that this war is surprisingly, or perhaps has turned out to be surprisingly conventional. Does that mean that the talk of multi-domain integration of forces and things, you know, was overblown, that we're not in that era?
Well, that's a great question, because I think a lot of people are reviewing this conflict and trying to figure out whether their own modernization programs were fit for purpose and their plans were right or not. But part of the problem is that if we draw lessons only from this conflict, we may miss some really important details and lessons that we should be learning from other types of problems. One of the things that multi-domain integration is supposed to do is digitize the entire battle space. It's supposed to mean that every single item in the inventory, every round of ammunition, every unit or call sign, as they call it, that's either in the air, on the ground, or at sea in front of you, is all connected. Now, that aspiration's still there. And perhaps what Western military forces are learning about this current conflict in Ukraine is that coordination and synchronization are vital. And it will be made a lot easier by digitization, if that can be achieved. But the nature of war keeps interfering. So the frictions of war, damage to networks and communication systems, the death of particular leaders, these always, always interfere with the model, the ideal that we think we're going to see in modern war. So those systems will have to be very robust, even if multi-domain integration is ever achieved.
Now, one of the lessons came out of the recent Defence and Security Review in the UK was this idea that, you know, we had to admit that we could never do the Falklands again. Do you think that what's happened in Ukraine should make us be thinking again, perhaps, about, you know, basic projection capability and basic troop numbers?
I think there's a big debate going on within the United Kingdom defence community at the moment about scale. You know, are there enough ships? Are there enough soldiers? And all those sort of scale issues. There's also the questions of coordination. So, you know, does the army need to do better in terms of coordinating its presence or its effect with, say, the Royal Navy? the Royal Navy are interested in the relative balance between doing diplomacy, humanitarian relief, and being present around the world, and developing what they call a capability for lethality. So in simple terms, the ability to fight battles at sea. All that is being reviewed at the moment. I don't know yet what those conclusions will be. But the interesting thing is, a trend that we've seen is that modern warships and aircraft are far more capable than the ones that we had in the 1980s. So what a modern frigate can do is the equivalent of potentially two or more other vessels that we had in the late 70s and early 80s. So could we do another Falklands? If that's a test, the answer is yes. But I think that the forces themselves would say, well, that was pretty touch and go. I mean, it could have gone either way, that conflict. It wasn't as a clear run thing as everyone said it was at the time. And that perhaps if you're going to be absolutely certain and robust, you're going to need a lot more force than you've currently got.
Yeah, I mean, on that question of scale and troop numbers, I mean, we make much of deploying people to Finland or to the Baltics or whatever. But every successive government I've covered for the last 40 years has actually cut the size of the army and the size of the force altogether.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And this is the first time with the Integrated Review and the Command Paper that we've actually seen an uplift of spending and a desire that while the army's getting smaller, it's the trade-off was to say, let's make it more modern. The Navy, of course, is doing the same thing, not quite the same scale as it was in the mid-1980s, but one that's far more capable. And there's no doubt whatsoever. I was a great skeptic to begin with about aircraft carriers, but you know, now you've seen them and you see what they're capable of doing with all the modern technologies on board. It is quite extraordinary that they are far more capable.
But I mean, there's a straight-off question. We don't have ourselves the planes to put on them.
Well, this is the point really I was just about to make about allies. I mean, the difficulty of measuring anything against the Falklands conflict, or indeed perhaps even Cold War, is that you think of things in terms of just what the UK on its own did. The really important thing about this modern NATO structure and about Sweden and Finland coming in now is that it is a very much integrated alliance structure. So take the Joint Expeditionary Force, for example, that operates in the Baltic. I mean, that is made up of many nations, and it's a pretty integrated force. They exercise every year. And I think that perhaps means that although you might not have perhaps specialist Arctic commandos and the numbers that you really want, what you've got alongside you, the Norwegians, the Finns and the Swedes, who are very, very good at it and frankly have a lot to teach the UK. So it comes up to the point you raised about multi-domain integration, that integration is across alliances as well as across the individual platforms.
Of course, it means that political alliances, as we've seen, are very, very important, which, I mean, some might say that the drift of Britain since Brexit has been in the other direction.
Yeah, that's certainly been the impression, isn't it? But, you know, we've all had an opportunity to review that because of the way that, you know, Russia has sort of created, forged a new cohesion across Europe. I think the thing that's been really striking for me is that the UK has been very eager to demonstrate that it is a European partner over this current conflict. So the UK defence world has been, frankly, in the lead at times about bringing new initiatives, supplying arms. I think what worries us all from an alliance perspective is its delicacy. Is it only going to last as long as this conflict in real terms? I don't mean in terms of is NATO going to survive, it will. But if we look at the willingness of France, Germany and Italy, for example, to go on long term with a confrontation against Russia, we have our doubts because they're all concerned about energy prices. So that's the weak link, really. And I think what the UK has to do and what NATO has to do in the United States is to continually work at the relationship and make sure that we all understand each other's national interests and help to mitigate each other's problems. I'm afraid the continuing fallout of Brexit in terms of the Northern Ireland arrangements, unfortunately, is causing some upset. But I think that can be overcome. I don't think that's a game changer.
And has this also confirmed, again, perhaps rather to our surprise, that nuclear deterrence still works, that, you know, Russia has threatened, but it appears to have backed off?
I think what's very interesting is for us to speculate not only about what if might happen, but also, you know, the calculus, the decision-making calculus going on inside the Kremlin. If Putin was to give such an order to use a nuclear weapon and that therefore we would say, gosh, our deterrence failed, I mean, we would see an incredibly strong reaction, not just from the Western world, but I think there are a number of Russian officers who would not obey that order because they know the consequences. And we saw Russian military spokesmen breaking ranks with the Kremlin's line. So I think perhaps deterrence will continue to work, not just because of, you know, what capabilities the United States has and how many warheads and so on, which is the way that gets counted, but because of what's going on inside the minds of the decision makers, the perception, if you like, of terror. It's what Albert Wohlstetter called the delicate balance of terror. And I think actually in terms of perception and minds, that's still there.
And you talk about the increased technological capability of things like the aircraft carriers and ships. I mean, how close are we to that sort of popular science fiction idea that in the future wars will be fought between machines with artificial intelligence without us getting directly involved until we face the consequences?
Ah, that's a very interesting sort of speculation, isn't it? I mean, I spend a lot of my time talking to scientists about, you know, what it all means, where this is taking us philosophically as well as scientifically. I think one thing is always evident, and people like to invoke Thucydides at this point and say that war is the human thing. It's a question of power and its relationship to politics, administered by other tools, other techniques. That won't go away. We're not going to, unfortunately, be able to do away with the human aspects of war. The tools, though, you're right, will change. And there will be, perhaps at the tactical level, the situation where technologies are able to, quote, talk to each other and to identify targets. Our hope is always that the humans will always be the final arbiter and decision maker. In the far future, that may not be the case. Of course, we may end up with smart clouds with no humans in them at all in terms of decision making. But we're a long way from that. And unfortunately, as this conflict is proving, that much of war remains quite old-fashioned, and we should continue to study that too.
And finally, coming back to the conflict, looking at what you've seen, what we know about the balance of forces and how the course of the war has gone, is it possible to see where this is going to end up?
It's a question I'm asked probably most of all. You know, what does the outcome look like? And it is very, very difficult to give sort of a clear answer about that question. You know, some people will go in for percentages and say, well, there's a sort of 70% chance it will end like this and so on. But war continually surprises us. It's a dynamic, escalatory phenomenon. We are hoping at the moment that the Russian army will continue to what we call culminate, that is to run out, exhaust itself, its manpower become increasingly demoralized, munitions more and more difficult to get forward, weather conditions adverse against offensive operations. And that as that war grinds its way to a slower tempo, I'm not sure it'll end completely, that perhaps there's an opportunity then for dialogue and political reasoning to reassert itself. There are other potential outcomes. I think the one we would hope for is a sort of court coup in Moscow, but the likelihood of that is very low indeed. I think what we might get potentially is some sort of broken-backed war that reignites itself from time to time. As we saw after 2014 in the Donbass or against Crimea, episodes of intense violence followed by longer periods of consolidation and stalemate. Another frozen conflict, perhaps, in other words.
An extended and broken-backed war may be the most likely outcome at the moment, since the two sides are still far apart on possible terms for a ceasefire. Some so-called realists, including 99-year-old Henry Kissinger, and perhaps voices in Paris and Berlin, believe that Ukraine will have to bow to Russia and yield up further territory beyond Crimea and the parts of Donbas already seized by Russian forces before the war began. The US, the UK, and most importantly, President Zelensky, insist that this would be unacceptable. When I spoke to Hugh Strawn, Professor of International Relations at St Andrews University and Emeritus Fellow of All Souls College, I asked him first why much of Ukraine, and especially Crimea, have been such disputed territory throughout history.
Well, I think that there are two reasons. One of them, of course, Ukraine's attractiveness as a productive area, agriculturally enormously important to Russia from Catherine the Great onwards, and particularly in the 20th century. And also industrially important, raw materials along Donetsk and elsewhere, which, of course, is where eastern Ukraine's industrial strength is still concentrated. But the other reason, too, is that Ukraine has always been the land in between, the buffer zone, if you like, between Europe and Asia, the point of conquest as well as passage from one to the other. And its frontiers are very hard to define. I mean, this is a part of Europe, Central Europe, which in Western Ukraine in 1914 was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Since then, chunks have been at various points Polish, Hungarian, and of course there is territory in Russia today, which Ukraine might traditionally see as part of its territory. So although the rivers within Ukraine provide clear north-south dividing lines, and we've seen that in the current conflict, it also has very few natural frontiers in other respects beyond the Carpathians in the southwestern corner, which does at least define Ukraine in relation to Hungary.
And what about Ukraine's identity? Is it fair to say that even when it's been occupied or in part of other people's empires, there's always been the idea of a Ukraine, and that therefore the kind of implications that President Putin is making, that really Ukraine is part of Greater Russia, is a delusion?
Its cultural identity is clearly very strong, and Ukrainians will say fiercely and with some reason that Kyiv is older than Moscow as a religious centre, as a cultural centre, as a linguistic centre. On the other hand, Putin doesn't come from this, the argument may be presented in bogus terms today, but he doesn't come from this without some reason. From the late 18th century onwards, Ukraine was seen as integral to Russia. Russia saw it as vital. It was the base of its warm water port, its sole warm water port, in terms of ability to get into the Mediterranean. That's changing, of course, with climate change. The northern ports are becoming more accessible more often throughout the year. But at the beginning of the 20th century, Ukraine was central to Russian identity for reasons that Putin's reflected.
And it's right to say, isn't it, that it's only really in very modern times that there has actually been a sovereign state of Ukraine.
Oh, indeed. I mean, there is briefly a Ukrainian socialist republic in the aftermath of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution that lasts for 2 years, and then control is re-established by the Soviet Union, and then only since 1991. So although, you know, Ukraine absolutely has its own language, its own religious identity, what it doesn't have is a long pedigree as an independent state.
You've written that prior to February the 24th this year, that there was a cold conflict in Ukrainian territory, particularly in the east, and that Russia was effectively winning. So was it a miscalculation to turn it into a hot war of invasion?
Let's call a spade a spade. I mean, this is a war that's been ongoing since 2014. And yes, it became, in inverted commas, a frozen conflict in the sense that it became static between 2014 and 2022. But plenty of people were dying and killing other people and being wounded.
But it was actually a sort of standoff, a bit like the trenches.
Well, it was. I mean, the Minsk Agreement was negotiated through the intermediaries of France and Germany, and that did indeed seem to freeze the conflict. Was it a miscalculation? Well, clearly in evidence it was. Was Putin misled by intelligence which told him the story he wanted to hear? Yes, self-evidently it was in hindsight. On the other hand, if you looked at Ukraine up until 2014, here is a country which actually reflected exactly the sort of problems it had had during the course of the 20th century, looking both to east and to west, looking to Europe and to Asia, balancing itself between Russia on the one hand and at least a history of German invasions on the other. And to that extent, producing a population which was, until very recently, itself politically divided on where it should stand.
There are those who are saying that the way in which the war has been fought sort of suggests, if you like, that blitzkriegs don't work anymore when you are up against a technologically comparable opponent, even if that opponent in numbers is much smaller. Would you agree with that?
Well, blitzkrieg never really worked in this sort of area. I mean, this is where the Germans came unstuck in 1941. In the end, there's a force-to-space ratio here. Ukraine's a very big country. And one of the reasons we think the Russians are failing is that although they've actually bitten off quite a lot of territory from Ukraine, especially if you take it back to 2014, they haven't conquered the whole of Ukraine because it's the largest country within Europe. And the trouble that any so-called blitzkrieg confronted, and the trouble the Germans confronted in 1941, is how do you sustain combined arms operations with armour leading in terms of their logistics? The distances are just too great.
Was the turning point the failure to capture the airport and therefore to capture Kyiv?
Yeah, I think that was crucially important in the sense that clearly if they had captured the airport and then got in quickly into the centre of the city, they might have avoided protracted urban warfare and they might have carried out a coup de main which would have had decisive effect. Whether it would have been backed up quickly on the ground is still open to question. I think what we underestimate here and what was underestimated in the run-up to the 24th of February was just how well prepared the Ukrainians were for this. I mean, you know, this is where the legacy of 2014 matters. They've had 8 years to think about this, and clearly they thought pretty hard about it and pretty effectively. And what that really is a tribute to is the operational security that they've observed. Even now, it's very hard for commentators in the West to get a clear sense of what their designs are. We get a much better sense of what Russian designs are, partly because that's what the press is obsessed with. And Zelensky's capacity to control the information narrative is wonderful, but what it means essentially is the top-down political story and the bottom-up human interest story are the stories that dominate. We know very little about what the current strength of the Ukrainian forces are, how many casualties they've suffered, what the state of their weapons is, how much of the equipment that's been fed in by NATO has actually survived contact with the enemy and how much has not, what ammunition stocks. I mean, these are all big questions.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about that. That one perception, you know, for me as a layman, would be to see all the shocking pictures of the destroyed Russian hardware and to suppose that maybe the Western-backed, to a certain extent Western-trained Ukrainian weaponry is just simply better than what the Russians have got these days.
Well, I think they certainly seem to be able to fire precision weapons with greater effect. And I think the air battle is important here because, as I understand the reports, one of the consequences of very effective ground-to-air weapon systems is that Russian aeroplanes are flying higher. They're using dumb bombs, not precision-guided munitions, and that's one of the reasons they're hitting targets they shouldn't be hitting. It's at least one excuse for war crimes. But it also means they're not achieving the military effects that they would like to achieve. And in some respects, this is why this has looked so traditional. It's become much more an artillery battle. And some of the reports from eastern Ukraine make you think of 1916 rather more than they do of 1940 or 41. I think the problem in all this for Ukraine is that if they want to regain territory, then armour has to come back into the battle. I mean, what they're doing very well is using these weapons for a defensive battle. They're using light infantry tactics. They're using the terrain they have. They're turning cities into very effective defensive zones. Mariupol being, of course, the classic example, but Kharkiv obviously being an example too. And that is working very much to their advantage. How do they turn defence into a counter-offensive seems to me much less clear.
And is that when, you know, some people again have been saying, well, Boris Johnson, amongst others, before the conflict said, you know, the eras of the tank are over. Is that where the tank comes back into its own?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not that the era of the tank is over. You still need protection in a vehicle if you're going to advance over terrain. That hasn't changed. But what you certainly need is effective air support, which the Russians don't seem to have had. You need to be able to think how you combine tanks with other arms. I mean, none of this is actually particularly new. And people have long recognised the vulnerability of tanks to precision-guided munitions. So you have to think about how you use cover, mobility and other forms of protection in order to make them more effective.
And what about the role of drones in all this?
Drones are very important. I mean, what drones are, though, is above all an enabler. I mean, what I'm assuming that one of the reasons the Ukrainians have done so well is that their capacity for constant observation and effective real-time intelligence has been very high. In other words, they've been able to track Russian movements. And this goes from the ability of men on the ground to use mobile phones, which is why Russians may look very suspiciously on those who use mobile phones, right up to drones and continuous aerial observation. And one of the other reasons, of course, that well, one of the other consequences of this is that we have seen, as outsiders not privy to covert intelligence, extraordinary satellite intelligence images and drone intelligence images, which have shown what's happening on the ground. You can't necessarily always interpret those images exactly as you would like, but they're still extraordinarily revealing. So the intelligence story has been told much more in the public space than would have been the case.
And that was a clear decision, wasn't it? I mean, that was a decision taken in Washington and London to a certain extent by FireEyes that they would go public with this.
Absolutely. And as non-belligerents themselves, at least not immediate belligerents, they felt free to do that. And by doing so, they, of course, they've mobilised public interest, they've mobilised public support. And speaking as an academic, I mean, they've mobilised academic interest because people like me are better informed than we might otherwise have been.
Now, I just wonder, is that a function? I mean, is that one of the big changes? Because, again, it surprised me that, you know, people still are using mobile phones, that you can still reach people on Zoom, that those systems haven't been knocked out. Perhaps it's impossible to knock them out now with low-level satellites.
I think you won't necessarily be knocked out, but you will be observed, you will be picked up, you will give away positions, you will therefore, I mean, you can't stay on too long, you need to move around, and any chatter which is intercepted, even if you don't necessarily know its significance, gives you an indication of what the other side's doing.
And this is a new level of a new aspect of conflict, really, digital communications.
Of course it is. It's in a way related to the point about drones. I mean, we think of drones primarily, you know, when the public comments, as weaponized drones, you know, the weapon that strikes sort of unannounced from the sky without the pilot putting himself in harm's way and so on and so forth. The intelligence, cumulative intelligence picture that they provide is probably far more important. In relation to what's happening in cyberspace, what's striking here is we haven't actually got a cyber war in the sense that cyber is acting as a substitute for the violence in war that's preventing the need to conquer territory because all you have to do is conquer the digital space. That's not happening. This looks like a very traditional sort of war, quite frankly. But what it is doing is enabling forces to actually be probably more effective in terms of conducting defence. I think, generally speaking, and you know, I'm tempted to make this a general point about warfare over the last 100 years, that one of the consequences of improved observation and improved intelligence acquisition is actually it enhances the defence at the expense of the offence, because you can anticipate when forces are massing. If you observe radio silence, then what you do, of course, is you lose command and control. So you lose the flexibility which you might want in the conduct of operations. So you have to trade off the danger that you will reveal what you're doing in exchange for speed of movement. And if you haven't got speed of movement, then you're not winning.
And you say this looks like a traditional war. And that, of course, means fought out to a certain extent by infantry. And it means extraordinary high levels of casualties, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. You know, absolutely. And I think one of the issues here in how this is fought and how this is sustained is how the casualty levels will play out and what political implications they will have. We've tended to assume, particularly in Western societies, that casualty levels of this sort of order are simply not sustainable. But I'm not entirely sure that's true. I mean, if both sides are committed to the idea that this is a war that has to be fought, then they will suffer the casualties that are required. And clearly, Ukrainians currently think that that's worth the fight. Russians maybe not. And of course, that in many respects is what Ukraine and its Western supporters and the international community are banking on. But it takes time, because the initial reaction to when people are killed in action is to say, and we saw this in Iraq and Afghanistan when the casualties are at much lower levels, is to say, this blood cannot have been spilt in vain. There still has to be a worthwhile outcome. And Russians are not going to be immune from that pressure.
Yeah, let's talk about that, the war aims, if you like, where we are realistically after months of fighting. What do you think the Russians, having not achieved what they wanted, what would they be prepared to accept a ceasefire with?
I think the Russians have a degree of realism. I mean, even they haven't shown much realism so far in the war, in that Putin has historically taken what he can when he can get it and then stood back when he can't get any more. I mean, that's really what happened in 2008 in Georgia. It's what happened in 2014 in relation to Crimea. I think it's perfectly possible to see him say, you know, look what I've got in eastern Ukraine, and with Mariupol and so on, I'll settle for that. The issue now is that that is no longer an effective negotiating position. The early stages of the war, when at least some negotiations were going on, it looked as though Zelensky might be prepared to settle for something along those lines. As the war has become more intense and the losses have risen, then Ukraine, and this goes back to the casualty point, cannot settle for that, politically cannot settle for that, not least because the Russian speakers within eastern Ukraine have not aligned themselves with Russia against many people's expectations. So Kharkiv, as a predominantly Russian-speaking city, has thrown the Russians out. So he can't settle for that. And he's being encouraged both by what's being said in Britain and now by what is being said in the United States to think that what he can actually aspire to is the return to the pre-2014 frontiers. In other words, he can get Crimea back as well. And if that's the case, he hasn't said that explicitly himself as yet, but if he is encouraged to do that, then we're in for a very long conflict, because the Russians in that part of what was formerly Ukraine do seem to identify with Russia and will need some persuading that they should now become part of the Ukrainian state.
I mean, again, realistically to me, it seems that politically the Ukrainians couldn't settle for anything less than 23rd of February territory, and that the real issue is going to be Mariupol, is going to be that corridor down to Ukraine, that even strategically, it doesn't, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem to me that a viable Ukraine could accept to have lost so much of its coastline and all of its coastline into the Sea of Azov.
No, I agree entirely. I mean, that what Ukraine's going to have to recover its economy, not clear, of course, how the compensation for this damage will be paid for, whether there'll be reparations demanded of Russia or whether there'll be a Marshall Plan for Europe or a bit of both. But Ukraine needs to return to being a viable state. And that means, of course, freedom to trade. It means the recovery of Mariupol. But also eastern Ukraine. I mean, Donetsk and Luhansk are parts of Ukraine which are rich and crucial, both industrially and agriculturally, to Ukraine. So it would seem entirely logical that they should demand their return rather than settle for the fact that they are more Russian in ethnicity and linguistically, and therefore could reasonably belong in Russia. And what the war has done has clearly forged a sense of Ukrainian national identity, which has overwhelmed any lingering Russian identity. I mean, at the beginning of the war, when you sort of chance figures with experts, they would say, well, 30% of the population are Russian or might be Russian-speaking. More than that are Russian-speaking, but 30% or so are Russian. But what seems to have happened is that those who are Russian, in a great majority of cases, are now fighting for Ukraine.
And Crimea? That seems to me probably the most negotiable part from the Ukrainian perspective.
Well, I think it has to be, because it is a much stronger Russian population. If it has assured access to the Black Sea, and particularly, of course, if the Sea of Azov were reopened, then those things might be acceptable. And Crimea is, of course, central to Russia's own economy, central to its ability to trade through the Mediterranean. And that is why Crimea, ever since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, has been so central to the debate.
So to sum up, would it be fair to say you fear that there's going to be escalation and more horror, but at the end of this process, the West as we understand it, or Western Europe, is perhaps going to be revitalized, and Russia, or certainly Putin's Russia, in a worse state than it was before it began?
Well, that's might happen, but war is the realm of contingency, and it doesn't necessarily follow a plot. I mean, one of the reasons that people go to war is that they're throwing all the cards on the table and trying for what they can get. So it's perfectly possible to see that as the outcome. But there are many dodges and turns between where we are now and where that might end up. And I think one of the challenges here is, of course, to think through what the desirable final outcome will be, the post-war situation will be, to think through the best routes for getting there, but always to recognise that the situation may change any day, and particularly it may change any day if there is a dramatic change on the ground, or if there's a dramatic change in terms of the decision to use certain sorts of weaponry, and particularly, of course, nuclear or biological weapons, or if there's a big change in the way in which the war is conducted outside Ukraine. I mean, can it remain contained? And all those things could throw so much back into the melting pot that although it's possible to see exactly the sort of ideal scenario that you're talking about as being a product, it's not self-evident. And we need to remember that most of the world is not taking part in this war to the degree to which Europe, Britain and the United States are. Most of the world is watching and are essentially sitting on the fence waiting to see which way things are going because they want to hedge their bets.
That was Professor Hugh Strawn ending this episode. Our thanks to him and to Dr. Rob Johnson. This is Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas, funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for public benefit. Marie Jessel is the producer of the Worldview podcast. Eve Webster is the assistant producer. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Thanks for listening.